Welcome everyone to iloverealestate.tv. Today on the podcast, what we're going to discuss is a topic that has been in the mainstream media now for probably 6 to 12 months. And it's something that the mainstream media is really building up to be a big thing, which I actually don't think it is. Now, the topic we're going to be talking about is affordability. You see, mainstream media is saying that it's too expensive for the, you know, the new kids getting out there. If you haven't got a home already, it's too expensive. You can't be able to buy a home. And of course, mainly they're talking about Sydney and Melbourne, which we will address as well. But, you know, across the country, that generally seems to be the feel. However, I was reading an article the other day that was actually published on the 11th of January, 1992. And the article was talking about, in fact, the headline on the Sydney Morning Herald was that Australia is one of the most unaffordable countries in the world, and Sydney's prices were, the world's highest, basically, everything was so unaffordable. But it was actually, as I said, was published back in 1992. Now, when you read the article, it talks about, you know, how the Sydney house prices were so out of reach of the kids that were getting out there and buying their first home, and nobody could afford to buy a home and all of these things. But do you know what the median house price was in 1992? In Sydney, it was $178,000. 178 grand in Sydney. Now, don't you wish you'd gone out and bought 200 or 300 of the things? Of course, the income back then was $34,500 as well. So, or maybe $35,000, something like that anyway. But, you know, that's the thing. It's all proportionate. So I really want to talk about affordability. I want to talk about housing. And I want to talk about what is the expectation of housing. Because I think the new generation coming through, going out and moving out of home, has an unrealistic expectation on housing. We've been brought up in a section of time where housing is the four-bedroom, two-bathroom, double lock-up garage in the burbs, and that's what they think they need to have, but it isn't. So here to discuss this whole topic with me, I have my good friend and long-term counterpart in the real estate game, Mr. Kevin Dudney. How are you, Kevin?
Hello, Dipna. How are you today?
Very good. Thanks, Kevin. Now, let me just introduce you a little bit for those of you who don't know Kevin. Kevin's been in the industry for what, 40 years?
40 years.
Wow. So he's obviously got some experience behind him for all you people listening out there. So Kevin, you know, you've obviously seen the ups and downs of real estate over the years and how these kind of headlines have hit the newspapers at periodically throughout your last 40 years experience.
I have indeed. I mean, it varies. They either have a concern about the interest rates, which at that time went as high as 30%, or they talk about things where it's out of control because it's beyond the one-third income level versus what the house is worth. Mm. So the fundamental rules that get the press going is if we spend more than about 33% of our income on a house, at which point it becomes unaffordable.
Well, that's exactly right. And I mean, I guess the debate really is then about wages growth versus housing growth, and are they staying in line? And, you know, then you have to look at areas, because the wages in Sydney, for instance, are much higher than they are in Brisbane or Cairns or, you know, Alice Springs.
They are, but it still comes down to the fundamental issue that every Australian can have their own home if they want to.
Yes, I think if they want to is a very important thing to add there, because not everybody does. And not everybody aspires to, you know, to have their own home.
No, and I mean, the thing is, we've been arguing this thing for decades and decades. This whole thing of shelter's been going for a long time. But fundamentally, there's so many different ways we can do it. See, it's not really affordability that's the problem. It's diversity of housing that's the problem.
So let's talk about diversity. What are you talking about?
Well, I guess I'm saying there that an example would be when I came out from England at the age of 6, my parents bought their home in a place called Redcliffe, and that was a typical four-bedroom home. It took them 25 years to pay that off. And our friends from Italy bought their first block of flats, mm-hmm. which were all individually titled. Mm-hmm. And the amount of people that wanted to own their own flat in those days was quite incredible. Mm. So if you could get a whole six-pack, as we used to call them, you had six titles.
That's right.
Today we've moved away from that. We just don't bother with strata titling to the degree of flats. Mm. And that market was so big in Australia that you could drive in any major city and see streets and streets of flats everywhere.
Now, of course, there would be the architects of the world that would argue that was, well, let's call it butt ugly.
Yeah, but the architects of the world stopped becoming architects in 1961 pretty well when we moved to cookie-cutter housing. Because true. Before then it was individual thinking and individual processes. Mm. But pretty well once we went into that great Australian dream in about 1961, it became the A.B. Jennings Australia, it became the what we would call a modern Metricon today or a Henley or something like that. Mm. So fundamentally all of our architecture is the same coming out of Melbourne because most of our builders are from Melbourne.
And that doesn't always suit other climates like Queensland.
It doesn't, and it further exacerbates it when we know that we've got 12 million vacant bedrooms right now because the average number of people in a four-bedroom home today is about 2.7 people. Back in the 60s, it was closer to 5 people.
Wow. And tell us about the sizing as well, because, you know, you look to some of our close neighbours, like in Asia and places like that, like Hong Kong, you know, density's probably gone to the other extreme in Hong Kong and Singapore and those sort of things. But how many of those kind of houses would fit into one of ours?
Well, I think it's a different way of putting that, but the short answer is about 22 homes would fit into one of ours. Mm. But if we look at the Australian standards, if we can call it a standard, it used to be 1:25 in the 60s. Mm-hmm. So if you had a family of 4 or 5, there was about 130 square metres of a home, and that was quite comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's more like 1:80 square metres or 1:100 square metres in some instances.
Mm.
And in fact, in the 80s, we got to 1:140 square metres, and it just became to a point where you just about have to have the family GPS to find them.
I know the feeling.
Yeah. So fundamentally, housing just got bigger and bigger. Why did it do that? Because in Australia, it only costs $7 a day more to get an extra 50 square metres of home or $2,500 a year on today's mortgage.
Yeah.
So we are upsizing.
Mm.
We have literally McDonaldized our homes today.
So where do you see this heading? Because, I mean, let's go back in your history. You were sent overseas by, I think it was L.J. Hooker or was it Hardy's? I can't remember. Sent you overseas to go and look at, you know, the future trends that were happening, you know, overseas and what we were likely to see more of back in Australia. What came out of that tour? Who sent you?
Well, there was actually 3 tours. The first one was James Hardy back into the American market where mm-hmm. we looked at 28 states over a month of different housing options, and from that I came back with the Smarter Smaller Home. The Scottish Expo was again compliments of James Hardy, and that was 52 homes on display in a place called Milton-on-Lees, not far from Inverness, where the average home was anywhere from 76 square metres, which they called a flat, to 120 square metres, which was a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom home.
Mm.
We don't even start building homes until about 180 square metres here in Australia.
Hmm. Okay, so what does that mean, though? What do you see happening here in Australia?
Well, for starters, it scares me. And what scares me is the incredible oversupply of just one product. We have no diversity of homes in Australia. We have your typical 4-bedroom stock, of which we know we have a massive oversupply. And the second things go a little bit pear-shaped. The rents drop $100 a week because everyone's got the same thing. But if you get down to a diversity of housing, you will always be safe with those smaller units, those smaller flats. So let's forget about units, let's forget about townhouses. We've got plenty of those. What we don't have is registered titled flats. Whatever you want to call that.
Okay, so what you're saying is, for starters, I mean, I think we need to go back further than that. I think we need to talk about expectation. Because, you know, when you've got the millennials and the Gen X's and Y's and whatever before them, their expectation of what was their right, I think, was too high. Because, I mean, you know, when I moved out of home, I obviously rented to start with, but eventually I bought a little place and then I bought, you know, got another one and another one, you know, and you moved up and, you know, you built yourself into a, you know, a better home, a better standard of living. I think the kids predominantly leaving home have an expectation that they need to have a house the same as they've just moved out of with their parents. Unfortunately, they forget the fact that it took them, their parents, 40 years to get to that standard of living. And, you know, along with that standard of living comes a whopping great mortgage, which of course then holds them back even further from being able to move ahead and replace income and these other sorts of things.
That's true, but one of the things I've always learned about history is that people buy a memory of architecture. And so these kids have been brought up with the 4-bedroom home and their ensuite and their family room and their media room, whereas the generation before that was brought up in a fibro nation. They were brought up
That's
in a 100-square-metre home.
Yep.
So their expectation, as a boomer we'll call them, was actually from their memory of architecture. So it's not that we should say that we have a problem with them or they have a problem with the market. It's that's all they know of the market. So
what's the solution? How do we educate these kids that they can get out there and, you know, buy a flat and then, you know, make some money on that and then move to a unit and then move to a townhouse, then move to a house and then move to a, you know, a block of flats or whatever?
Well, I think it starts with demonstration. The oldest trick in the book is show and tell. And back in 2009, when I built a two-storey, 120-square-metre home that was illegal to build anywhere in Australia because the covenants were 180 square metres, we had to build in a shed. Once we did that, the councils allowed it to be built. Then we built a 65-square-metre home for two families. On one side, 25 square metres for one person. Back to that, what I said before, 1 is to 25 square metres.
Mm.
And they said, wow, that's comfortable. And I could have that fully furnished at $180 a week. Just the furniture rental package is $150 a week. So you're literally getting your digs at $40 more. And the other thing is, a tent site's $210 a week today.
Wow.
So we can actually create beautiful spaces with fold-down beds in 24 square metres. Or on the other side, we created a room for five people at 34 square metres.
Five people living in 34 square metres. You've taken that to the extreme now.
Well, because we can. Because, you see, the one thing the new generation have
is... What are they doing sleeping on top of each other, the ceiling?
Mum and Dad have got their own separate bedroom with an ensuite at night or day bathroom during the day. The kids have got a fold-out day bed, which doubles as a double bed. And then we've got this fold-out mates rates hotel that I call it, which folds out of the breakfast bar. So it's ideal for someone who sees some kids coming and going, mm-hmm. and so it gives you your own space.
Mm.
But it's a flexible space.
But for a young, you know, young couple or young individual moving out, that's plenty.
It is, and I've got some suggestions for those kids. There's two things they can do. One, they can build what they consider is their dream bit on the top floor or even on the ground floor,
mm.
and then they could create another three units, if you like, within that existing space of 200 square metres. That would give them more rental income than the whole mortgage.
Mm.
And if they then wanted to travel, the home's paying itself off.
Yeah.
That's one way you can do it if you want to get into debt up front.
Yeah.
Or if you want to go the other way, which is how the Greeks and Italians did it back in the 60s, you buy your first block of flats, might start as a duplex.
Mm.
So as an example, let's build a duplex on one title instead of two and get the income so they need cash flow.
Mm.
But let's build it so that we could potentially subdivide it later.
Yeah.
And then trigger that into the infrastructure charges and all that other stuff that comes with it. So let's design it for the future, but let's use it for the cash flow as it starts early.
Mm.
And then when we move from a duplex, we go to a triplex, a fourplex, and a block of flats.
Mm.
So literally you're doubling and doubling and doubling.
Mm.
And before you can look around, you haven't got what I call a boarding house, but you've got six or eight titles.
That's right.
Sell down six, keep two.
Or not.
Or not.
Keep them all, positive and cash flow.
Or the latest trend in America. And I love this one, where they decided to take a piece of land and not call it freehold title and just use it as a caravan park.
Yeah.
They build their first home at $50,000. They've worked out that you can pay that off in 7 years,
mm.
and you're living in a space that's about 30 square metres, maybe 25 square metres, but it's very tall, so you've got volumetric space of another 15 square metres,
mm.
so it's probably closer to 36 square metres. You pay that off in 7 years at $50,000. You then sell that, and now you've got your $50,000 deposit.
Mm.
That gives you enough strength then to go to your bank and say, I've got enough equity to do the next step.
And this is the tiny homes, revolution that's happening around the world.
Yeah, which is really, it's really another name for a caravan.
Because, yeah, I guess. A big one.
Yeah, a big one. Mm. And we actually built one only a couple of weeks ago for our big seminar that we did with Jamie Drury and all the gang. And that was a two-story, 4.3-metre high one, which, incidentally, the police did stop on the road and argue that it wasn't a caravan.
Overweight too.
But, you know, it got there and we just showed how much volumetric space you can create.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, okay, so we're talking about the mortgage-free house. You skipped over
Lost
that a little bit.
Yeah, I did.
But, like, I've got kids in this age group and each of them are buying their own homes now. Each of them, the older two anyway, have gone in and done things differently. Both of them went out and bought an investment property first.
Yes, that is so common at the moment.
Because obviously the interest is all tax deductible and all those things, but each of them bought a property that was positively geared. So they both of them ended up with a property that needed a little bit of work, but it was positively geared. And each property each one of them bought gave them an extra income for serviceability to be able to get on and then buy their own home. So they bought an investment property first, positively geared, made money out of what they did to the property, so they created equity in the property as well, and then now are in positions to be able to go and buy their first home. Son's doing things a little bit differently, but the daughter, she's doing a mortgage-free house.
Right. Well, the one in question being Sam, she started off with a little unit in Kangaroo Point there at 100 and... I think it was about 105,000 or something like that.
It was ridiculously cheap.
And so at the end of it, I think straight off 125, and then we spent about 25 on it. I owed about 155, and then it was valued at 210.
Yep.
No brainer.
Yep. And now, rents out at 380 or something, $400 a week, something like that.
Good high level. And it's 21 square metres. Yep. Not a big space, but nice on the river, all that sort of stuff. But I think when you look at mortgage-free home, let's explain that simply. Take 200 square metres of space, figure out how you can cut 100 square metres of it into, say, three or four separate apartments. Now, you've got to make a decision here. Do you make them legal apartments or do you just make them space? In my opinion, just space.
Mm-hmm.
And then the top floor is your own space, which would be 100 square metres for you. You might have a rooftop garden, which goes over the two-car comm. That's deemed to be probably a five-bedroom home in most places, subject to what 565 councils you're in.
Yep.
So you'd have to check that. But basically now you've got five spaces, your own private space which you can lock up and know that it's safe, travel if you want to, and you've got four incomes at about $250 a week on the model I'm working on. There's $1,000 income, $52,000 a year. That's big cash flow.
And on a build, depending on what city it was in, that's likely to be $10,000 to $20,000 positive cash flow, depending on what the land cost you?
Very easily.
Yeah.
And depending on how expensive we're going, if it's more like Sydney or more like Melbourne, then it's just a question of which
suburb.
Melbourne's
not too bad, you know.
No, it's not. No, Melbourne's actually quite affordable for its population.
It is. It certainly is. I was reading some stats the other day about the Australian Bureau of Statistics expects that in the next 30 years, Sydney and Melbourne will have 8 million people living in each of them. And Melbourne will actually slightly surpass Sydney.
Yeah, but what concerns me about, say, the next generation is they believe in the lie that the city's the place to be. And when you look at the actual numbers, about 11 or 12% of the whole population of, say, Brisbane, 13% actually, lives within 5 kilometres of the CBD, less on percentage in Sydney, within 5K, and less than Brisbane is also Melbourne. So they range from about 11 to 13% who choose to live within the first 5K of any of our major cities. And yet that's where the infrastructure is being spent. That's where the restaurants are. That's where all the stuff is that they think they should have. But we can oversupply that so quickly because it's such a small market.
And I'm a little concerned about some of the construction of this high-rise stuff that's going on at the moment too. I mean, we saw what happened in England with the cladding that's being used. Not that I'm scaremongering here, and I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily what's here, but there is, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's happening that's stretching the code, let's say, with that, you know, inner city high-rise stuff that really, you know, out a little bit is probably where you're going to get the better builds as well.
I think what we're talking about here is the suburban environment. And, and when we talk about that, or when I'm talking about that, where the action is those middle suburbs that had those big blocks of land.
That's right.
Because if you must then buy your next thing because you've got out of your flat or you've got out of your duplex, get on a block of land which is maybe 2,000 square metres or 1,500 square metres, cut a couple of blocks off it, and you're going to be about $200,000 positive straight up from there.
That's exactly
so right. So keep bouncing until you can keep cutting blocks off. Mm. And that middle ring's got transport, it's got the shops, it's got the schools.
One thing I will say, particularly for Melbourne, but also for Sydney to some extent, you know, the infrastructure spending that's going on there with the road upgrades and the links and the train upgrades and the ring roads and all of this sort of thing, what it really is doing is pushing that boundary out further. And within still quite reasonable travelling distance to the city or to the major shopping centres and that sort of thing. So it's really expanding the city. Where I guess Sydney has not been as good at that for a long time. Sydney isn't as planned, I suppose, as Melbourne is either.
Yeah, that's true. But what we also have to look at is technology change. By that I mean that at the moment, as an example, there's a big market in, say, aged care.
Yeah.
But with driverless cars, that means as you age in place, you can stay in your existing home because the thing that makes you move is that lack of a license, that
travel,
lack of mobility.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all of a sudden, by solving that problem with a car that can drive you anywhere without you driving it, and that's not far away, it means that something like aged care specialities can disappear because we can start to age in place.
Yeah, within reason. I don't know that I'm 100% with you on that one. I think we're at least 15 years away for starters. And the other thing is that I think, you know, a lot of the aged care, particularly that middle range aged care, it has all the other services as well, like, you know, the person who comes in does the cleaning and the lawn and all the rest. I know you can pay for all of that sort of stuff, but a lot of people haven't got the finances to be able to do that in the ageing population. So I think the smaller aged unit is still going to be popular.
It is.
And in communities too.
And I think, well, let's take another lesson from the boomers if we can for a second. Back in 1962, pretty well every Australian who was a boomer had about the same amount of money.
Yeah.
Over a period of 30 years, it became 80-20. 20% had 80%, 80% had 20%.
Yep.
If we look at the Generation X, about 80-20 now. If we look at the Generation Y, not there yet. Mm. But what we're seeing is probably even the millennials. No matter how we shuffle the cards, there's going to be a need for 80% more diversity of housing and 20% of aspirational housing. At the moment, Australia's 80% aspirational housing and 20% diversity of housing.
And that's why we get the complete swings in the market, you know, with the boom and crash, basically, where you've got, you know, the mortgagee and possessions and all of these kind of things, because people are reaching for the aspirational housing when perhaps they should be with something smaller and more affordable.
And they always sell it at exactly the same time, which means it floods the market.
Correct.
And that's
Well, you're responsible for that.
Thank you. It's a gift. I think what Dipna's saying there is because I sold 850 homes through the market of Channel in 1 year, I'm still paying for my sins on that. So, yes, we did create a boom in Rockhampton, and we did sell 300 things in 1 year.
In a small community, you killed it.
I did, thank you.
Yes. Yeah, it's not good for all of those people that rushed out and bought them, I might add. But anyway.
No, but, and let's look at this from the marketer point of view. They represent such a big market. Mm. Let's look at what they are asking for.
Mm.
They've got a new thing called DNQ. And I said, what on earth is that?
Mm.
So they've just come back from a course with them and they've said, we have now 65% of our clients buying investment properties that do not qualify.
Mm.
So now they've tasked me with a job and to come up with house and land across Australia between 275,000 and 330,000. So they're saying that's the sweet spot for 65% of people who can't buy what they're currently offering for sale.
Right.
Now there's a clue for you.
Mm.
So if that's a clue for you, what I guess I'm saying to you and the people listening is we can now find real estate at 195 to 225 to 250 to 275 in scale and give that to our marketers.
Who will promptly add $40,000 to $80,000 on top of that and then sell it and pocket the difference.
I hope so. That's what they always do. And I know that doesn't sit well with you.
No, it doesn't.
Well, that's probably why you've asked me to help your students by maybe giving that back to them.
That's exactly right.
So, yes. But I think the key point I'm saying here is if your marketers are now asking for the first time in 30 years a diversity of housing, they're at the pointy end of the arrow.
That's what's going to change it.
That's what's going to change it.
Yeah, because they've got the marketing machine to make it change.
Well, they were the ones who introduced more or less made the granny flats famous.
True.
They're the ones that made the auxiliary dwelling famous.
Were they or were you behind them?
Well, actually me.
Yes.
Let's
get serious. I mean, I'm not joking here. This man is the revolution behind housing and has been for a lot of years. And, you know, he creates trends. He creates markets. And the granny flat market and the, you know, the second dwelling and the smaller and all of these things have all originated from Kevin. And, you know, it's just other people have picked up on them and made them popular.
So let's look at my next favourite one.
Okay.
So at the moment, we're designing it out of China.
Right.
Now, I've always said modular is like a teenager pretending to be an adult, which I've always said is a dangerous thing.
Mm.
But modularisation has been around for a long time. Back in 1945, we called it prefab.
Yes.
So it's just a new name for an old technology.
Yep.
So with prefab housing, I can now create a ground floor area, which is maybe 10 metres by 7, which is 70 square metres.
Yep.
But I can get another 30 square metres of volumetric space or a mezzanine floor by making the ceiling 7 metres high. So that means I can create a 7 metre high ceiling with modular and it still all fits in the container that leaves from Shanghai. So it doesn't care whether it's a 2.5 metre ceiling or a 7 metre ceiling. And it doesn't matter on cost, it's just space.
I want to see the drawings on those and the costs.
And I've done it, and the costings are done, and we'll be building our very first one in less than 10 weeks' time. It's my favourite toy of this year.
Good. I'll be coming to have a look.
It's magnificent.
We should do a Facebook Live on it.
I think we'll call it Smarter Smaller Home 3.
Okay. Let's call it that.
I think it's a good name. So we're testing that, and what we're going to do is then add two of them, because you see, what we're paying then is, let's say it's $1,000 a metre. Let's say that's our goal. Mm. So we're only paying $70,000 for 100 and something square metres of space.
Wow. That's
because of that volumetric thing.
And that's what you can land it for?
Yes.
And build it for?
That's the question, which is why we have to
connect
do that.
To services?
Yes, that's included. So at the moment, we know what we're getting it out of China at. The guy that's behind this is an Australian, so it's to standard.
Mm.
But we can use different product now acceptable to Australia, magnesium boards and other things, which have a higher fire rating.
Right.
So we don't have that towering inferno issue.
Yeah. Yep.
Because some of our fire check products just don't last that 90 minutes.
No.
And I tell you, there's no such thing as a safe building anywhere in the world past 7 stories. Past that, there's no fireman's ladder tall enough.
No.
So that is just unavoidable.
Mm.
So all I'm saying is, Australia's a big place, we can do low rise, but on this one, I'm not just building one of these 70 square metre modules, which is 103 to 110 square metres or more, I'm actually building two.
Right.
And the reason I'm building two is one on the other side pays for your rates, it pays for your outgoings, it pays for your costs, so that what happens is you're $5,000 positive on one side, and that helps you with your mortgage repayments on the other.
Mm.
And
very
I'm not
good.
Saying make it two titles, make it one for now.
Yeah, okay.
So back to the old duplex.
Well, let's have a look at them. Let's look at the figures.
Okay, well then that'll be coming live in less than 8 weeks.
Well, to be adjourned, guys. We'll have another chat a little bit further down the track when Kevin's got this thing up and running. And we might even do a bit of a Facebook Live around it and have a look at it.
So let's call it diversity of housing instead of affordable housing. It
diversity confuses. Of housing, yes.
Yeah.
And altering belief systems, because I think that's a big part of it.
And I think the final note is if 92% of every citizen in Singapore can own real estate, and they do.
Yeah.
I did a little digging on that research. About 80% of them own a flat.
Yes.
And that's the change in thinking.
Yeah, and it's building from there.
Yeah, own your own flat.
That's exactly right. Well, thank you, Kevin. It's been a delight sitting here talking to you, as per usual, and we'll be back again to talk to everybody very, very soon. Now, I'm going to ask everybody to do me a little bit of a favour. Get onto iTunes. I know it's a bit of a hassle, but get onto iTunes for me and rate the podcast. If you're enjoying them, please rate them and put some comments in there, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to be checking out those comments and I'm going to be giving away some books. I've got lots of books and prizes and things to give to everybody. I'll just be drawing people at random, but I'll be drawing them from the people who actually who rate and make a comment. So pop on there, pop onto iTunes, and if you're enjoying them, go and tell your friends about them. Thank you very much to everybody, and remember to visit my website www.iloverealestate.tv, and thank you again, Kevin.
Thank you.
Okay, bye for now.